You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. My great pleasure to introduce Michael Cunningham, who is the author of the novels A Home at the End of the World, Flesh and Blood, The Hours, which won the Penn Faulkner Award and the Pulitzer Prize, and Specimen Day. Michael works in Greenwich Village, is where he writes 4 to 6 hours a day, after which, a period like that, he told a recent interviewer, he likes to run out on the street to hear someone singing an aria with their hair on fire. That is Manhattan, of course, and Manhattan... Michael's beloved Manhattan is the setting for his latest novel, By Nightfall, which centers on a middle-aged art world couple, Peter and Rebecca, whose lives are upended when Rebecca's wayward younger brother, Mizzy, takes up residence in their Soho loft. And reading this beautiful book, there's just so many moments. I had to put it down because the psychic resonance of Michael Cunningham's sentences are so amazing. And he recently commented on the novel, "Emotional physics are often counterintuitive. People don't necessarily act the way you thought they ought to act. We are not logical organisms." And that's what he captures in this novel in exquisite detail, resulting in a sly and witty tale of the mysteries of beauty and desire, art and delusion, age and love. In conversation with Michael tonight, we are very happy to have Tony Valenzuela, who's a writer and longtime community activist. He's a leading voice in the gay men's health movement. He's currently the executive director of the Lambda Literary Foundation, and he's written and produced an acclaimed one-man show, The Bad Boy Next Door, which has toured a dozen cities in the U.S., and he's published fiction, journalism, and essays, and is currently working on a memoir. Please welcome Michael Cunningham, who will begin by reading Tony Valenzuela. Thank you.
I'm going to read a short section from my novel, By Nightfall. This section involves the main character, whose name is Peter, who has been sort of summoned to lunch on the Upper East Side by an older art dealer named Betty Rice. It's a warm April afternoon, suffused with bright gray glow. Peter walks the few blocks to the Spring Street IRT. He's wearing beat-up suede boots and dark blue jeans and a light blue unironed blue shirt under a pewter-colored leather jacket. You try not to look too calculated, but you are, in fact, meeting someone at a fancy restaurant uptown, and you want, poor fucker, you want to look neither defiantly downtown, pathetic in a man your age, nor like you've nicened it up for the dowagers. Peter has gotten better over the years at dressing as the man who's impersonating the man he actually is. Still, there are days when he can't shake the feeling that he's gotten it wrong. And of course, it's grotesque to care about how you look, yet almost impossible not to. Still, there's always the world, which conspires constantly to remind you, no one cares about your boots, pilgrim. There's Spring Street on this spring day. Is it a false spring, though? New York has a habit of squeezing out one last snowfall even after the crocuses are out. The sky so blank you can imagine God forming it with his hands like snowballs and tossing them out, saying time, light, matter. There's New York, one of the goddamnedest perturbations ever to ride the shifting surface of the earth. It's medieval, really, all ramparts and ziggurats and spikes and steeples, entirely possible to see a hunchback cloaked in a hefty bag stumping along beside a woman carrying a $20,000 purse. And at the same time, overlaid is a vast 19th century boomtown, raucously alive, eager for the future, but nothing rubberized or air-cushioned about it, no hydraulic hush. Trains rumbling the pavement, carved limestone women and men. not gods, looking heftily down from cornices, as if from a heaven of work and hard-won prosperity. Car horns bleeding as some citizen in Dockers passes by telling his cell phone, "That's where they're supposed to be." Peter descends the stairs into the roar of an oncoming train. Betty is already seated when he arrives. Peter follows the hostess through the dark red faux Victoriana of Jojo, a restaurant. When Betty sees Peter, she offers a nod and an ironic smile. Betty, a serious person, would wave only if she were drowning. The smile is ironic, Peter suspects, because, well, here they are, at her behest, and sure, the food is good, but then there's the fringe and the little bandy-legged tables. It's a stage set. It's whimsical, for God's sake. But Betty and her husband, Jack, have had their inherited six-room pre-war on York and 85th forever. He makes a professor's salary, and she makes mid-range art dealer money, and fuck anybody who sneers at her for failing to live downtown in a loft on Mercer Street in a neighborhood where the restaurants are cooler. When Peter reaches the table, she says, "I can't believe I've dragged you all the way up here." Yes, she is, in fact, irritated with him for agreeing to come, for thriving, relatively speaking. "It's fine," he says, because nothing cleverer comes to mind. "You're a kind man, and not a nice man. People tend to get the two mixed up." He sits opposite her, Betty Rice, a force. Silver crew cut, austere black-rimmed glasses, Nefertiti profile. She was born to it. Jewish daughter of Brooklyn leftists, may or may not have dated Brian Eno. Has a good story about how Rauschenberg gave her her first Diet Coke. When he's with Betty, Peter can feel like the not-quite-bright high school jock putting moves on the smart, tough girl. Can he help having been born in Milwaukee? She lays her eyes a waitress, says, "Coffee." Doesn't care that her voice is louder than it needs to be, that a 60-ish perfect blonde glances over from the next table. Peter says, "I hope you're willing to talk about Elena Petrova's glasses." She holds up a slender hand. One of the three silver rings she wears is taloned like an obscure torture implement. "Yeah, Angel, it's sweet of you, but I'm not going to put you through the preliminary chit-chat. I have breast cancer." Betty, no, they got it. Thank God. "What I really want to tell you is I'm closing the gallery right now." "Oh." Betty offers him a slip of a smile, consoling, maternal even, and he's reminded that she has two grown sons, neither of whom is particularly screwed up. Betty says, "Yeah, they got it this time, and if it comes back, they'll probably get it next time, too." "Yeah, I'm not dying, not even close to it. But there was a moment when I first heard what it was, and you know, my mother..." "I know." She gives him a level, sobering look. "Don't be too eager to be good about this, okay?" She says, "Yeah, I wasn't so much terrified as I was pissed off. Yeah, the gallery's been my whole life for the last 40 years, and frankly, I've been sick of it for the last 10. Now that it's all going to hell and everybody's broke... Anyway, one of my first thoughts was, if this doesn't kill me, Jack and I are going to change our lives. And so, yeah, we're going to go live in Spain. The boys are fine. We're going to find a little whitewashed house somewhere and grow tomatoes." "You're kidding." She laughs, a dense, throaty sound. She is one of the last living American smokers. "I know," she says. "I know. Maybe we'll be bored out of our minds. Then we'll sell the goddamn little whitewashed house and go do something else. I just don't want to do this anymore." Jack is sick of Columbia, too. "Blessings on your journey, then." The waitress brings Peter's coffee, asks if they've had time to consider the menu, which they haven't. She says she'll check back. She's a sweet-faced, sturdy girl with a Georgia accent, somebody's much-loved daughter, probably newly arrived in New York, determined to sing or act or whatever, extra genial, eager to seem as much like a waitress as she possibly can. Betty says, I want to love art again. I'm going to skip forward just a little bit. Betty and Peter have finished lunch and gone to the Metropolitan Museum. Do you know? Do you all know the sort of famous Shark by Damien Hirst? It's an extremely controversial work of art from 20 years ago. It is essentially a 13-foot dead shark floating in a tank of formaldehyde, which is currently on display at the Met. An hour later, Peter and Betty walk together through the great hall at the Met, a grand, somnolent portal into the civilized world. Why deny its satisfactions, its elephantine poise, its capacity to excite the very molecules of its own air with a sense of reverent occasion and queenly glamour and the centuries-long looting of five continents? The hall receives with a vast patience. It's the mother who will never die, and right up front are her votaries, the women of the central kiosk, elderly for the most part, kind-looking, waiting to offer information from under the enormous floral arrangement, cherry blossoms just now, that festoons the air over their heads with petal and leaf. Peter pays the admissions, Betty paid for lunch. They clip on the small metal circles. Now, these things must have a name. What would it be? He to his jacket, and she to the scoop neck of her black cotton sweater, which for a moment draws both their attention to her prominent freckled clavicle and the miniature gathering of wrinkles, like a puckering of cloth that have settled into the skin between her breasts. Betty knows that Peter is looking, gives him back a look of what he can only call haggard flirtation. A furious sensuality, not directly sexual, but charged with some quality made up of sex and defiance. The sort of look Helen must have aimed at the Trojans. Betty Rice, a queen kidnapped by age and illness. He times his ascent of the staircase with that of Betty, who climbs at a smoker's pace. She's just had a Marlboro Light in front of the museum and said, in response to the skeptical glance Peter had decided against, "Trust me, a cancer scare is not the time to give up smoking." At the top of the stairs, Tiepolo's Marius continues to triumph. The boy continues banging on his tambourine. On the way to the contemporary galleries, Peter pauses before the Rodin at the entrance to 19th century European. Betty gets a few paces ahead, turns, and comes back. "It's still here," she says. "They came for the Hearst. Why is Peter stopping? Hasn't he seen the Rodin 1,000 times? Peter says, "You know how..." "Yes." "How something pops out at you sometimes." "Today Rodin pops out." "Yeah, I don't know why." Betty settles beside Peter with that aspect of mother alligator calm she can summon. This is probably how she was with her sons when they were small, when they were fascinated by something that bored her, this attitude of informed but charitable willingness. This would be part of why they turned out okay. She says, "No denying its merits." "No. Here it is, as always, August Net, a.k.a. the Vanquished, a.k.a. the Bronze Age. Perfect bronze man-child, exactly life-size, trim and lithe, holding his invisible spear. Rodin was still unknown when he sculpted and cast this naked man, sans ancient Greek musculature or French devotion to allegory. Rodin, a minor figure then, but proven right by time. The heroic was dying out. The real was arriving for a long, long stay. Now Rodin has been and gone, and yes, of course he's part of history, but new artists don't revere him. No one makes a pilgrimage. You learn about him in school. You pass his sculptures and maquettes on your way to see the Damien Hirst. Still, it's fucking bronze. It could last forever. Didn't the Koenig sphere survive 9/11? Alien archaeologists might unearth it one day. And really, would it be such bad evidence of who and what we were? August Net, centuries dead by then, his name lost, but his form preserved. Nude, unidealized, merely young and healthy with his life ahead of him. "Okay," Betty says. Okay. They walk quietly and with purpose by the Carrier and de Chavannes, past Jerome's Pygmalion kissing Galatea. At the gallery's far end, they turn past the books and gifts kiosk. Turn again. And there it is, the shark, suspended in its pale blue, strangely lovely formaldehyde. There is the lethal perfection of its shape, and here's its maw, jagged, big as a barrel head, the business end. Is there any other creature so clearly intended to be a mouth propelled by a body? It remains a jolt. It still produces that prickle of animal panic along the surface of Peter's skin, which is, of course, one of the questions. Who isn't going to be moved by a 13-foot-long dead shark floating in a tank of formaldehyde? Betty says. It has to do with the immaculate packaging, Peter thinks. The hefty but pristine white steel tank, 22 tons. The azure solution in which the creature floats. The shark is so entirely contained, so utterly dead, its eyes opaque, its hide hoarily wrinkled. And yet, it's something seeing it here, Betty says. It is something. The physical impossibility of death in the mind of someone living. Yes, it's something. Three girls and a boy, 14 or 15, circle nervously around the tank, appalled, deciding how exactly to mock it. A little boy holds his father's hand and says, "This is scary," posed as a question. A middle-aged couple stands by the shark's tail, huddled, conferring gravely in what sounds like Spanish, consulting each other as if they've been sent to do something painful but necessary for the greater good. Betty says, "This one's a female." "Do you think they should have kept the first one?" "Oh, there was no way Steve Cohen was going to have paid $8 million and just watch the goddamn thing disintegrate." "No, no way." "It's a little hard to see it at this point," Betty says. "I mean, there's the object, and then there's Hearst's career, not to mention Hearst himself. And there's Cohen's $8 million and the Met thinking it's daring to show something that's been around almost 20 years. The high school kids gathered before the shark's midsection, all but trembling with fear and sexuality and disdain, speaking softly in a private language. Peter catches bits. "You're such a handbag." "Handbag? No, he must have misheard." "Never. Never have. Thomas and Esme and Prue." One of the girls puts a hand on the glass, pulls it quickly away again. The other two girls shriek and run from the gallery as if their friend has set off an alarm. Betty strides up to the front of the tank, bends over slightly to see into the shark's open maw. The girl who touched the glass remains, the boy beside her. She fingers the seam of the boy's jeans. Young lovers, then. The girl's face is resolute, small-mouthed, something pious about it. She could be Amish, never mind the Courtney Love t-shirt and green leather jacket. She's a handsome and probably intelligent girl contemplating a shark alongside her boyfriend. Who is gay? Anyone can see it. Does he know that yet? Does she? And Peter is briefly in love with her, or anyway, with who and what she'll become. There she is 10 years from now, in a tight little sparkly dress, laughing at a party somewhere. And then the boy whispers to her, and they leave, and Peter will never see her again. "It's impressive," Betty says of the shark. "You let yourself think, oh, it's a gesture, it's just a dead shark. Every natural history museum is full of them. But then you stand in a gallery with it, and, well..." Betty has grown bottom-heavy with age. She's wearing black Reeboks. As she leans unafraid toward the mouth of the shark, she's touching but not heroic. No, she is perhaps heroic in her way, but she's not potent. She does not possess even Ahab's doomed and fanatic grandeur, though she has, in her life, had some measure of his crazy conviction. Think of the artist she's taken on. But now, on a Sunday afternoon at the Met, she is an old woman looking into the mouth of a dead shark. Peter goes and stands beside her. It's an impressive gesture, he says. Behind Peter's and Betty's dim reflections on the glass, the shark's jaws gape. There are the rows of lethal, serrated teeth, and beyond, pickled white, is the orifice itself, which takes on the shade of the solution's blue, grayed and deepened as it recedes into the shark's own inner darkness. Betty has not told Peter the truth. Not the whole truth. The surgeon didn't get all the cancer. She's not going to be all right. Peter knows this with a tingling immediacy that's like the creaturely alertness produced by the shark itself. An infinitesimal length of tape self-erases in his brain, and he'll never know if he understood at JoJo's or later. Betty is, in fact, dying, and will do so sooner rather than later. That's why she's closing her gallery right now. That's why Jack is leaving Columbia. Peter reaches over and takes her hand. It's more or less involuntary, and only after he's touched her does he pause to wonder, is this ridiculous? Is this melodramatic? Will she rebuke him? Her fingers are surprisingly soft and crepey, an old woman's. She squeezes his hand with hers, gently and quickly. They hold hands for a few seconds, then part. If the gesture was excessive or false, if it was self-dramatizing on Peter's part, Betty doesn't seem to mind. Not now. Not in front of the shark. Thank you. Hey, Tony, before we get started, I have to briefly mention the true heroes of the evening. My father and my lovely friend Esther and my impossibly beautiful sister, Christy, who have now sat through this reading two nights in a row. Thanks, guys.
Well, thank you, Michael, for that. Out of curiosity, I want to know from the audience, how many of you have had the opportunity to read By Nightfall? Okay, a few of you, a good number of you. So we'll get started. The reading that you just gave, this passage you just read, reminded me of another scene early in the novel where Peter and his wife Rebecca are on their way to a party.
Yeah.
And the traffic is backed up, and they're in a cab. And what's happened is a carriage horse has been struck by a car and killed. And Peter is fascinated by this horse. It reminds him of his brother Matthew, who died of AIDS 25 years earlier. He recalls the secret exhilaration of washing his brother's corpse, of being a part of that death. Death is a metaphor for many things in this novel, for loss, for the ends of certain kinds of cultures, and especially as the way that the characters wrestle against it or are resigned to it. It's a subject that you deal with deeply in many of your novels. It's also a way that you explore beauty and desire in this book. So my question is, what is this relationship between death and beauty that you're asking the reader to consider?
I tend to think of death when I refer to it in my books as the sort of death represented by the particular tarot card. If you've ever had your cards read, up comes the death card, and if you're new at it, it's actually not one of the ominous cards. There are a few cards in the tarot deck you really don't want to get, like the devil and the hanged man. But the death card is actually about the end of one way of life and the beginning of another. The death card is actually about something ending and something else beginning. Which is really kind of what I'm thinking about when I write about mortality, It's really though not all my characters survive to the ends of all my books, I do think of it not so much in the morbid sense as I do in the sense of sort of shedding an old skin and taking on a new one. I'm a cockeyed optimist at heart. I'm just fond of the kind of optimism that's hard won.
The couple, Peter Harris and his wife Rebecca, they're prosperous, successful. They've been married for 20 years.
Yeah, 20
a while. Yeah, they're enviable from the outside, and yet at the end of the first chapter, Peter fears, and I'm just reading a bit from the end of this chapter, that in the face of all evidence to the contrary, that some terrible, blinding beauty is about to descend, and like the wrath of God, suck it all away, orphan us, deliver us, leave us wondering how exactly we're going to start it all over again. That blinding beauty ends up being his wife's little brother, Ethan, known as Mitzi or the Mistake.
Yeah.
Because he was conceived by, he was an accident and conceived much later,
right,
after the siblings had grown up. So Mitzi is this fascinating, amazing character. He's in his early 20s. He's Ivy League smart and aimless. Mm-hmm. He's dropped out of Yale. He's just come back from spending a month in a remote mountainous village in Japan staring at a rock garden. He's struggling with drug addiction, and he's also a beautiful young man. Now, the arrival of Mitzi tests the relationship of this couple, and Peter is reluctant. He's not looking forward to this visit from Mitzi, but then something happens, something changes. He allows himself to be seduced by this beautiful young man, his brother-in-law. What's going on with Peter Harris?
What is going on with Peter Harris? Well, that is a good question. Peter is a straight guy. Certainly straight enough, certainly 99% straight, who finds himself, and 99% is a lot of straight. excuse me, a little cough. Who finds himself drawn not really sexually, but sort of sensually to this impossibly compelling, beautiful young man in very much the way he is drawn to the Rodin sculpture. I don't know if you've seen it, but it was sort of revolutionary in its time. Just a brief pedantic aside, because I'm a geek and I can't help myself, as I sort of alluded to in what I just read. It was one of the first sculptures to actually depict the body as it appears in life. It wasn't romanticized. It wasn't all muscular and we would say steroided out, though that was not what the Greeks were thinking. And Peter finds himself drawn to this kid who enormously resembles Peter's wife, Rebecca, when she was young and they were first in love and full of hope. For his youth, for his beauty, for his questionable but still abundant future, I felt like I wanted to do a kind of, this is a bit of a stretch, but a kind of Romeo and Juliet story, a doomed love. If it was simply a book about a gay guy coming out and coming to terms with his love for a boy, it's not that interesting to me. Nor would it be if Rebecca had a sister and Peter just sort of went after the sister. Where it gets interesting to me is the whole notion of this eroticized but not erotic connection that Peter feels with this boy, who is like a work of art to him, who is
like a performance,
not entirely
piece
human,
you
like
see,
a like a, yeah, like a human, like a living perform, like an ongoing performance piece. Yes, exactly.
As you know, I'm the director of the Lambda Literary Foundation, and our mission is to sort of raise the profile of gay and lesbian letters, of supporting LGBT authors and books that explore the LGBT experience. So this question stems from also about Mitzi, stems from that position with Lambda Lit. You wrote an essay in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, a fantastic essay about translation in literature. Yeah. And you define translation of literature, you give it various layers. There's the translation of the novel from one language to another, which you describe as requiring the translation of authority and musicality.
Right, right.
There's the translation of the novel that's in the writer's imagination into the novel that he or she ultimately writes, and there's the translation of the text that every reader brings to the text.
Yeah, yeah.
And my question is, do you imagine that the characters of Mitzi and Peter might be, that the LGBT community might translate those characters differently than heterosexual readers?
Sure, sure. I think no two readers ever read exactly the same book, and I'm perfectly happy for people to read my books in whatever way they choose to read them. I, as a gay man, have felt like it was important for me to be out from the very beginning. I feel like that is probably the only obligation a gay person has. You know, be a Republican if you must. dress all in leather or move to the suburbs and have children, or dress in leather and move to the suburbs and have children. That is entirely up to you. But I do think it's enormously important for all of us to be simply frank about who we are. I've never tried to make any kind of issue out of it one way or another. But when people say, "Are you gay?" I say, "Uh-huh. Next question." Mm-hmm. And I feel like I am a writer who is gay, I'm a writer who's American, I'm a writer who's white, I'm a writer who's tall, and all of those facts, maybe not height so much, have about as much and as little to do with what I write as any of the others. And while I feel an enormous loyalty to the LGBT, always hard to get all that out, community, I also feel my own compulsion to write about the biggest world I possibly can. And as, of course, all of us know, there are lots of people in the big world, some of whom are gay and some of whom are not gay. And I sort of...
Most of
many
them.
Of I see several people here. I suspect maybe practicing heterosexuals. Go ahead, admit it. Come out. You know who you are. And I feel like if you take on any kind of agenda as a novelist, you're in trouble. So I feel not only free to write about whatever I choose to write about, I have found to my delight that as far as I know, my gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, we have to come up with something a little shorter than that, don't you think?
Some people say queer, but you know.
Yeah.
It's a loaded word.
Yeah, the love that dare not speak, that they don't know what to call itself. Have stayed with me. And I mean I feel like many of us are ready, willing, and able to live in a big, diverse world that's partly gay and largely not gay.
Yeah, in By Nightfall, there's all this delicious sexual tension and some moments of transgression that are just so well done and that you don't read often in literature. And it's just really more a comment than anything that what you do with Peter and Mitzi, and it's true, it's not sexual, it's something else. was really startling.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's a most welcome comment. Thank
you. So the novel is set in the art world, and there's this scene early in the novel where Peter and Rebecca go to this party, and at the party there's wealth and fame and pretension and obscure art, and there's, it could be argued, some interrogation of at least some elements of this world. But there's also, through your portrayal of your characters, your honest and tender portrayal of these characters, an admiration and respect of this world. So I'm wondering if you agree with this assessment, and also, how did you settle on the idea of the New York art world as a setting for this novel?
Let's start from the back and move forward. I have a lot of artist friends and a couple of art dealer friends, and that world has always been fascinating to me, though much smaller than Hollywood and largely based in New York. It is every bit as vicious and avaricious as Hollywood. Much less explored by romance novelists than Hollywood, but it's intense, it's rough, and big art is big money, and where there's big money, there's lots of shenanigans and lots of chicanery, and that world has always fascinated me, and it gave me the chance not only to live vicariously in it, but to sort of spend a week with a fantastic gallery owner named Jack Shaiman and sort of live as beside Jack as an art dealer.
Yeah, that was another question, how you researched this.
Yeah, oh, God bless Jack Shaiman. He let me sort of talk to clients and sort of act like I was an art... Surprise! You thought I could sell you a painting, didn't you? And I am... I don't want to go on and on about this, though Lord knows I could. I'm fascinated by the whole question of how art and money intersect and who decides what the serious art is. Because, you know, the art market is controlled in more or less the way that De Beers Company controls diamonds. A book is different. A book sells in multiples, and the more copies a book sells, the more successful it is. A work of art is singular. And in order to be worth money, it has to be rare, it has to be precious. And so while there are probably, by any reasonable estimate, several thousand significant artists at work in America, we're only allowed to have about 60. Because otherwise the art economy collapses. And I'm interested in the machinations involved in that and the kind of decisions made behind closed gallery doors about who's in and who's out, who's big and who's small. And at the same time, cynical as I may be about all that, would I rather somebody with big bucks spend it on art than stock in Exxon? Yeah, I would. So, in another sense, anybody who buys any work of art is a hero to me.
The art world, as a setting, is fertile ground to explore this notion of our terror of becoming irrelevant. And I wonder, this is something that the characters in the novel all grapple with in one way or another. And I wonder if you were thinking about that idea before you decided on the art world as setting, or if the art world as setting came first?
Yeah. I mean, I think first came the idea of this man at a sort of crisis point in his life, and he's obsessed with beauty, and who what better job for someone obsessed with beauty than dealing art? Usually the occupation comes later. This is a complete tangent, but I just have to mention it quickly. Mad Men? the great TV series. You know how that started? That started as somebody, this guy whose name I forget, who writes the series, wanted to do a story about neglectful parents, about being the child of neglectful parents, and in the 50s, because his father was a neurosurgeon, his mother was a desperate housewife. The guy has to have a job. What should it be? Oh, I don't know. Let's put him in advertising, and it evolved from there. Which is I guess germane in that it illustrates how you often end up telling a story very different from the bare bones of the story you thought you were going to tell. Poof, the art world, who knew?
One of my favorite chapters in By Nightfall is called Night Town, and it's a reference to Dublin's red light district in Ulysses.
Yes, it is.
And Peter Harris goes through this just stunning 2 a.m. walk through Manhattan's neighborhoods, and he's speaking to his estranged, aggrieved daughter, Bea. And your description of New York is just breathtaking. And throughout the novel, and actually in several of your novels, you describe New York, and you just did in your reading, as this place with full of contradictions. There's the potholes and the stink in front of the Chanel boutiques.
Right.
And sort of as Peter walks through Manhattan, it reads like an homage to New York, but also like a eulogy, because Night Town no longer exists in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so this question has to do with the relationship of the city to the artist. There's another part in the novel where Peter is lamenting that great art used to be produced in places that inspired the artist, but that now they can only afford to live in, like, the outer borough.
Right, 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 where beauty is scarce.
Right, exactly. And one of your artists, in fact, in the novel, lives in Bushwick, I think. Bushwick, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So how has the relationship of the city and the artist changed, in your opinion? And do you think that in the digital age it matters anymore?
I think it matters less and less. I think New York is on its way out as some kind of world capital of certainly the production of art. I mean, well, here we find ourselves in Los Angeles, which is every bit as full of incredible artists, young and old, as New York, and has an incredibly alive, vibrant gallery thing going on. And I think we are seeing a diversification and a kind of globalization of human creativity that is good news for everybody but about three dozen gallery owners who have places in Chelsea. But yeah. Goodbye, New York, as the sort of be-all and end-all. Hello, big world. Hello, L.A. and Seattle and Austin and Santa Fe and you name it.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if the definition of urban will change, what that means,
yeah,
when it's not so much the concentration of Manhattan anymore.
Yeah. Though I have to say, step outside my apartment on 16th and 6th Avenue, and you can't help but think, whoa, urban.
Yeah.
when somebody lying in front of your vestibule, sort of tugging on your pants leg, saying that he knows where Marilyn Monroe is still living, and a wind blown plastic bag has wrapped itself around your face, you can't help but think, whoa, urban.
Let me see what question I want to ask next. Without giving the ending away, there's one of the thoughts I was left with after finishing the novel was this idea that the noise in our heads, the lines of songs that keep playing over and over, the private thoughts that we have every day in our minds can be very different from how we might describe ourselves to other people. In this novel, you've taken interiority to another level. We don't just listen to Peter's thoughts. There's something unfiltered about his thoughts. It's almost like a meta-interiority.
Yeah.
Was this intentional?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It was. I feel like a certain level of interiority is what the novel does best. It's what the novel is for. A novel is really still to this day the best tool for creating empathy, because a novel can take you into the deepest recesses of another human being. I love movies. I love TV. I love all forms of narrative, but none of them can do exactly that. They do other things that a novel can't do, but a novel can take you right into the heart and soul of a person, and because you've invented this person, unlike, say, in a biography or a history, you can go as deep as you want. You can actually put your hand through his chest and through his heart and sort of tickle his backbone. And why wouldn't you want to try to do that?
Yeah, I think it was Jeanette Winterson who wrote that the reader becomes Peter in reading this novel.
Whether they want to or not.
Yeah, whether they not want to or not. Well, you know, speaking of the characters, it's interesting that the characters in the novel are not exactly likable people, but I mean, they're navel-gazing and sometimes exasperatingly
at times.
Yeah. And yet, I mean, so are we. And they're flawed but relatable, sort of like windows into our insecurities and vanities.
Mm-hmm.
We end up caring about these characters, and that's not easy to pull off as a writer. How did you do it?
I don't know. Next question. That's very kind of you. I just have to cite my favorite novel of all time, Flaubert's Madame Bovary. Actually, I love this. There's a line that I took from Flaubert, from Madame Bovary. We bang on a kettle to make a bear drum when we would move the stars to pity. And I don't ordinarily read reviews, but I read a very short early one, sort of by accident, which said he's such a wonderful writer. For instance, this line, which was flipping. Thanks. I'm sure some of us have read Madame Bovary and some of us have not, but I think what Flaubert did in that novel changed the novel forever. He took Emma Bovary, who is, by any reasonable measure, a shitty little person. You know, she's shallow and vain and petty and petulant. She's not even a good mother. She doesn't even pay close attention to her child. She's not subject to grand passions. She reads sentimental novels. She wants to go to parties. And by looking at her so closely and so intently and insisting on her for the novel's full length, for its 388 pages, he makes her a great figure. Emma Bovary, a major figure, a name I'm sure all of us recognize, whether we've read the novel or not. And part of what Flaubert did by focusing the way he did on Emma, without prettying her up, without making her any nicer, without giving her depths she didn't possess, gave us to understand that if Emma Bovary can be a great literary figure, anybody can. Everybody qualifies. And that changed the game. Up until then, literature had been about heroic figures. And along comes Gustav F., who says essentially, no, 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 I'm going to write about the least heroic imaginable person and make you care about her and make you understand what it's like to be her. And that's why I steal lines from him in the hope that critics will give me credit for them.
Well, we have about 15 minutes for questions and answers, so I think for Q&A with the audience. So
I'd love
that.
I
want to go ahead and open that up. And I'm going to call on folks. So if you just raise your hand, I will. There'll be a couple of people in the audience who are going to bring microphones to you. And who has questions? The gentleman in the back row there, and then we're going to do second the gentleman right there.
I find it interesting that you use the present tense in a lot of your writing. And I'd like you to just comment about it. It's very poetic, et cetera.
Thank you. You know, I find that the question of tense, past, present, or future, there aren't many novels written in the future tense, of course, and point of view, first person, second person, third person, are entirely intuitive and have to do with my own relationship to the story I'm telling. And I don't think about it for a second. I just start writing and, oh, it seems to be in the present. It seems to be in the present tense, third person. What do you know? It is some kind of sort of unanalyzable evidence of how closely or how far away from I want to stand to the particular story I'm telling. And I teach, and every now and then somebody in a workshop will say, with every good intention and with every right, I wonder if you should think about writing this in the past tense instead of the present, or the third person instead of the first. And I've learned not to gasp over the very notion that something as fundamental and deeply personal as tense and point of view could possibly be questioned. I try to maintain to the students that in my opinion these are just sort of in your DNA and the story's DNA, and they simply match up in a way that's not subject to question. But I get a lot of argument about that from my lovely students, who I encourage to argue with me, even though I'm usually right.
You talk about tense being entirely intuitive. I wonder about where you started with this story, whether you had Peter and Rebecca as two folks in New York, and whether Missy just appeared, or whether you knew about, and you talked about the art world sort of appearing poof, and how organic your process is and how structured.
My process is almost entirely innocent of structure. Flannery O'Connor once said, "Well, how can there be any surprises for the reader if there haven't been any for the writer?" And I agree with Flannery O'Connor on almost everything except Catholicism. and I have found that, though, believe me, there are plenty of amazing novelists who are very structured. It's not like my way is the way. It's simply my way. I have found that if I know too well where a story is going, the best it's going to do is get there, in a sort of Swiss music box way, with a kind of dreadful Swiss precision. Apologies to all the Swiss people in the room. Please don't send me angry emails, people of Switzerland. And there's a certain pleasure to standing on the platform and seeing the 3:15 train roll in right on time, but I hope for something a little more ragged and a little less expected than that. And I have found that if I work through sort of trial and error and intuitively, which is hugely uneconomical, it involves throwing out tons of pages as I go along because I get a bad idea in my head and I take the novel down some path that doesn't where it doesn't want to go. Still, that affords me the greatest possible chance of writing something that's a little smarter than I am, which is, I think, what we're trying to do. We're trying to transcend our own limits, work from our unconscious, and write the novel that is not the novel we thought we were going to write, but the novel that we are meant to write.
Hallelujah.
Thank you.
I saw another... in the third row, and then there was another hand up in the back here.
Yeah, one
over here. Okay, then right. Oh, Stephen. Okay.
So, pardon me, I'm getting over a bug. So, when you're writing, then it's almost as it's unspooling out of your subconscious, as opposed to you're planning to write about X. It rather starts to happen once you get going.
Yeah, it starts to happen once I get going. You rely on your unconscious to to create patterns, and then a great deal happens in the subsequent drafts. No one will ever see the first. If I have anything to say about it, oh please, please don't let me die on stage with my various drafts hanging around. No one will ever see, if I have anything to say about it, the early drafts of these great, messy, terrible, sprawling things, because you just kind of let it all out, and then you look back and see, oh, in the hours, flowers here, flowers there. I wonder what that's about. Maybe we should put flowers over here too. Then you start to pattern and arrange. Once you see what themes seem to want to emerge, then the calculation steps in. I don't think even Jack Kerouac didn't really write On the Road in one sitting on one long piece of paper. That is a myth that I'm here to dispel. Even Jack Kerouac, we love you, but you played us a mean trick. So much of it happens in revision. A part of a novelist's job is taking something sprawling and kind of terrible and trying to make something less sprawling and less terrible out of it by seeing what you can do with all these pages lying at your feet.
Michael, your past few novels were like very structurally experimental in the way, like the hours and Specimen Days, and this novel was incredibly moving, and its structure is like a very straightforward narrative. So I was wondering what was the challenge that you set before yourself? What was the great experiment of this novel?
You know, I don't think of myself as an especially experimental writer. What I do try to do is, when I'm trying to tell a story, start by asking myself if I can tell it in the simplest, most straightforward manner possible. And if that proves to be impossible, then I start trying in other ways. I think it would be disastrous to sit down and say to yourself, I am now going to write an experimental novel that will break with form. I think that would be sort of wrong. This is just the first time I've had a story to tell that seemed to want to be told in the most straightforward possible manner. And so there it is. You always, of course, have to put the good of the story ahead of your own desire to be flamboyant, much as I would love to be flamboyant. I'm not. Look at me. I just have to quickly, this is slightly related. When I was in graduate school, I had a great teacher named Hilma Wallitzer, who took me aside. She didn't say this to any of the other students. It was just meant for me. She said, Michael, when you finish a story or anything, any piece of writing, I want you to go through and give every sentence a grade of either A or B. The great ones get A's. The perfectly adequate ones get B's. And then you go back and take out all the A's. Because the A's are advertisements for yourself. The A's are about you as some kind of junior Olympic skater. The A's are about your attempt to dazzle the reader with your verbal pyrotechnics, and they're not in service of the story. And I thought, oh, shit, you're right, aren't you? Oh, I hate when people are right about anything, really. But I still abide by that. I still try to tone the language down, and the reason I think of this is I try to tell each story in the most efficient manner possible, and to think of what's good for the story and not necessarily good for my reputation as a renegade and an outlaw. Maybe one or two more. I feel like I don't want to keep people too late.
Yeah. The gentleman in the back there, and a second question, anyone? Okay. The gentleman.
Yeah, thanks. One of the things that I always found kind of interesting in your novels is that although the characters are really different, they all have this level of intricate detail to them that when I'm reading, I feel like it's hard for me to imagine how you captured what these characters are feeling on such a detail level. And I'm just wondering, like, do you draw these characters off of your own experiences or out of other people you know, or how do you create these characters in your novels?
They're composites, really. None of my characters has ever been taken directly from life. They're always sort of mixed and matched. And I make some things up. I borrow this quality of my friend Marie's and this quality of my friend Stacy's, and Marie has a way of doing this thing with her mouth when she doesn't agree with you. So I think, oh, that's good. And Stacy has a way of ending her sentences as if there were questions. That's interesting. You make it up, but out of bits and pieces. And you use what you know as somebody who's simply living a life. Eudora Welty once said that, as far as she was concerned, you could write about any outward experience that you could imagine. You don't have to have worked in a logging camp to set a novel in a logging camp, but you probably can't write about any experience, any emotion you haven't experienced. If you've never been in love, stay away from love stories. So, in a sense, all my characters are really autobiographical, up to and including a lizard woman from another planet in the next century. I just try to keep my inner lizard woman under control. Is there last one in back there?
I think that's it,
John. We're out of time. Thank you.
Please thank Michael Cunningham for us.
Oh, thank you, Tony.
You're wonderful. Thank you, Tony.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.